From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, more buildings occupied by pro-Russian insurgents in eastern Ukraine, help for the needy in Syria, aid rush to South Sudanese before the rains cut off the roads, plus the racial controversy in U.S. professional basketball. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Demonstrators seeking more regional power stormed an administration building in Luhansk on Tuesday. Luhansk is one of the largest cities in eastern Ukraine. Insurgents there have seized control of police stations and other government buildings. They've also done that at least 10 towns and cities in eastern Ukraine. Demonstrators who stormed the building in Luhansk on Tuesday, like those elsewhere in the east, seek a referendum on granting greater authority to Ukraine's regions.
Народна власть, яка сидить в СБУ, наші герої, защитники.
One mass demonstrator told the Associated Press that the people's government in Luhansk had proposed that the Kiev authorities hold a peaceful referendum. And at a news conference in Kiev on Tuesday, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt said it's been suggested to the interim government in Kiev that they carefully deal with the pro-Russian insurgents occupying buildings in eastern Ukraine.
Our advice would be to encourage the government to continue on the course that it has been pursuing, of seeking a strategy to cordon these cities, to use their security forces and the army if necessary, to ensure that weapons, money, instability are not trafficked in and out of these cities, but not to engage in the forceful clearing of these buildings.
And Ambassador Pyatt also spoke about possible U.S. response should Russian troops cross the border into eastern Ukraine.
Russian troops crossing Ukraine's borders would be a major escalation and would draw an inevitable sharp reaction from the United States. And I think that's understood by everybody. It would be a dramatically unfortunate development, which I think would produce only the most tragic consequences.
Russia has amassed tens of thousands of troops in areas near the Ukrainian border, feeding concerns that Moscow aims to use unrest in the east as a pretext for invasion. Russia has also accused the United States and NATO of what it called provocative statements as the crisis in Ukraine unfolds alongside NATO military buildup in Eastern Europe. Meanwhile, diplomatic efforts are continuing to seek the release of seven observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe who are being held by pro-Russian gunmen in eastern Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell has our story.
Transport planes brought about 130 U.S. Army paratroopers to Estonia on Monday, part of a NATO show of force in Eastern Europe. Several NATO members have sent warplanes and ships to the region. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said Tuesday the military buildup was accompanied by provocative statements about the need to contain Russia. NATO commander in Europe, General Adrian Bradshaw, insists the deployment is appropriate.
Our judgment is that the actions that we've taken at the moment are proportionate and appropriate to the changed security dynamic that we face. It gives a very clear indication of NATO commitment to the region.
Russia is also building up its forces in the region. Two naval vessels have returned to join Moscow's Black Sea Fleet based in Crimea, the region Russia annexed from Ukraine last month. The highest tensions since the Cold War have prompted accusations of covert military intervention in Ukraine from both Russia and the West. Seven observers from the OSCE were seized by pro-Russian gunmen last week in the flashpoint city of Slovyansk, accused of being NATO spies. Five Ukrainian soldiers were also taken hostage. The observers were paraded in front of television cameras Sunday. The leader of the mission, German Army Colonel Axel Schneider, said they were in Ukraine strictly in line with their OSCE mandate.
And I clearly state, the Vienna document diplomats come to the nation without arms, without ammunition. We are not fighters, we are diplomats in uniform.
The militants want to exchange the OSCE captives for pro-Russian activists held by the Ukrainian government. Among the hostages are three German soldiers and one interpreter. Berlin's Defence Minister Ursula von der Leyen visited their home barracks Monday.
Es ist das erste Mal, dass in einer solchen...
She told reporters this is the first time that inspectors were apprehended during such a verification mission of the OSCE. She added, that's why it is all the more important to make clear that we will not be bullied and this will not jeopardize further missions, quite the contrary. The Vienna-based OSCE was created during the Cold War as a forum between East and West. Observer missions often include army personnel, but their role is strictly diplomatic, says Andrew Foxall of the Henry Jackson Society, a Britain-based policy analyst organisation.
To evaluate events on the ground, to monitor how the situation is developing, and then to make suggestions or policies for how the situation might then develop.
The OSCE's 57 members include Russia. Western countries say it is up to Moscow to put more pressure on the pro-Russian gunmen to release all the hostages. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And you can keep updated on what's happening in Ukraine, plus the world's reaction, by going to our website, voanews.com.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Two bomb blasts in Iraq killed at least 15 people on Tuesday, a day before the general elections set for today, the first since U.S. troops withdrew in 2011. No one claimed responsibility for the attacks, but Sunni militants have been accused of similar acts and attempts to derail the political process. At least 50 people have been killed in bomb and mortar attacks in two Syrian cities. In Homs, two car bombs exploded in a mainly Alawite neighborhood, killing 36 people. Meanwhile, in the capital, Damascus, mortar shells killed at least 14 people and injured more than 85 others in the Ash-Shahour section. Police say some of the shells landed near a religious school and that some of the pupils were among the casualties. Syria's government blamed the Damascus attack on terrorists, a term it uses for the rebels fighting to oust President Bashar al-Assad. Meantime, 35 experts on international law and humanitarian issues have signed an open letter calling on the United Nations to do more to deliver aid to the millions of people in Syria who desperately need it. VOA's Al Pessin in London is following the story.
The open letter published in European newspapers says the United Nations is too concerned about violating Syria's sovereignty and should do more to force the Damascus government to allow humanitarian aid into the country. The experts say the legal commitment to Syria's sovereignty is outweighed by an international doctrine called the responsibility to protect. The concept is that if states do not protect their citizens from mass killing and other crimes against humanity, the international community has a responsibility to do so. Professor Stephen Chan of the University of London is one of the signatories.
I just think that the humanitarian situation in Syria has become so desperate that the time for legal caution has passed.
The letter acknowledges that taking a more aggressive approach, such as trying to send in relief convoys without permission, could be dangerous. But Professor Chan says armed convoys have been used before in other conflicts. He says it may be time to try that in Syria.
The Syrian government would be taking a huge risk in terms of what little respect it still has if it were to attack a humanitarian convoy.
Chan says the letter writers want to pressure the Syrian government and rebel groups to allow the aid to pass. But he says, more importantly, the United Nations needs to authorize a more aggressive humanitarian approach.
The key objective is the United Nations, but also within the United Nations, pressure on the Security Council and particularly on countries like Russia, to facilitate what is intended here in our letter very, very much as a humanitarian exercise.
The United Nations says more than 9 million people in Syria are in urgent need of assistance, and 3.5 million of them are in hard-to-reach areas. The authors do not expect one letter to change that, but they hope it will add to the pressure on Syria and its supporters to do something to ease the suffering. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has asked Egypt's interim government to address recent disturbing decisions in the country's judicial system and prove its commitment to democracy. He spoke about the Cairo government's efforts to make reforms.
Even as these positive steps have been taken, we all know there have been disturbing decisions within the judicial process, the court system, that have raised serious challenges for all of us. We will discuss these issues today very candidly, forthrightly. And we do so in a spirit that wants to find a way for Egypt to be able to make it through this transition and share a full democracy with its people and be able to take the steps that create the stability and strength that is necessary for a country like Egypt, where everybody looks to the potential of Egypt's reemergence on the global stage as a major partner in our strategic concerns.
Mr. Kerry's comments came a day after an Egyptian judge sentenced more than 680 people to death. All of the men sentenced were supporters of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood, the party of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. On Tuesday, Secretary Kerry met with Egyptian Foreign Minister Nabil Fahmy of the State Department. While Mr. Fahmy did not comment on the sentencing decision on Tuesday, he did speak about Egypt's judicial system.
They are completely independent from the government, but of course, they're part of what Egypt is all about. I can't comment on the content of the decisions themselves, but I'm confident that due process is allowed, and that the legal system will ultimately end up with the proper decisions in each of these cases. And we will build a democracy based on the rule of law, and the rule of law means applying laws that are consistent with the Constitution through a legal system that's independent and credible to us all, most of all, to the Egyptian people.
While Foreign Minister Fahmy and Secretary Kerry met at the State Department, the powerful leader of the U.S. Senate subcommittee overseeing foreign aid said he is blocking military aid to Egypt after it sentenced the 683 Muslim Brotherhood members to death. Democrat Patrick Leahy said Tuesday he's not prepared to sign off on aid to Egypt until the U.S. sees convincing evidence that its government is committed to the rule of law. Mr. Leahy said he's extremely disturbed by what he says is the Egyptian government's flouting of human rights and appalling abuse of the justice system. The Obama administration is relaxing a ban on military aid to Egypt imposed after the violence that came when they toppled Morsi last July. The U.S. was planning to send Egypt $650 million in military aid and 10 Apache helicopters. Also in the news, the UN Refugee Agency says it is racing to provide essential supplies for hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese who are displaced by the war, and to do that before the rains make the roads impassable. Lisa Schlein reporting now from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Nearly 1 million South Sudanese have become internally displaced since fighting between government and opposition forces broke out 4 months ago. They are spread across about 175 makeshift and organized sites, with the largest number in Upper Nile State. UNHCR spokeswoman Fatoumata Lejeune-Kaba describes conditions in most of these sites as appalling. She says they lack water and sanitation. She blames the terrible conditions on underfunding and lack of security.
It's not everywhere that we can access all the time. The lines of fighting move constantly. The displaced themselves move constantly. So even if they receive assistance in one place and they are forced again to flee because of new fighting, they find themselves with nothing. It's overcrowded for most of them, including, of course, at the UN bases. The sites are not proper at all.
Lejeune Kaba says the UNHCR is airlifting more relief supplies Tuesday from Dubai to the capital, Juba, for 100,000 displaced people. She says the blankets, sleeping mats, water buckets, and other relief items will be distributed mainly in Unity, Upper Nile, and Jonglei states. The UNHCR also is assisting thousands of South Sudanese civilians who have fled to Sudan in search of asylum. Lejeune Kaba tells VOA the agency's priority is to relocate 23,000 South Sudanese in White Nile State away from where they presently are staying.
We've had visits there to the relocation areas, and it seems like people will be willing to go. It's important because very soon we won't be able to access the Kilo 10 site. So most likely people will move and relocate.
Lejeune Kaba says it already is raining in White Nile State, but the heaviest rains usually begin in May. Meanwhile, the UNHCR and its partners also are providing aid to tens of thousands of South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia. She says aid agencies are expanding accommodation for nearly 100,000 refugees in the Gambela region in the west of the country. She says land is being cleared for a fifth camp near Kule for up to 30,000 people. She says the camp is expected to open early next month. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Officials from the Democratic Republic of Congo say 40,000 illegal immigrants have been driven across the border from neighboring Congo in the past few weeks. Authorities in Congo-Brazzaville launched an operation called the Slap of the Elders earlier this month to expel the illegal immigrants. It's part of a government crackdown on illegal workers who frequently cross the river between Brazzaville and Kinshasa, the DRC capital. Many of those who have been sent back to Congo-Kinshasa complain of brutal treatment by Congo-Brazzaville police. Brazzaville's mayor has apologized to anyone who has been mistreated and says guilty police officers will be punished. UN Security Council has lifted a ban on diamond exports from Ivory Coast and also moved to ease an arms embargo. The council on Tuesday adopted a resolution lifting the diamond embargo that was put in place in 2005 in the wake of the country's civil war. The measure also relaxes the arms embargo so Ivorian security forces can acquire small-caliber weapons. Ivory Coast UN Ambassador Youssoufou Bamba hailed the vote. He speaks here through an interpreter.
The resolution recognizes the urgent necessity for the government of Cote d'Ivoire to train and equip its security forces, especially the police and gendarmerie, with significant weapons and ammunition to carry out their security missions and peace maintaining order.
Ambassador Bamba said the end of the diamond export ban recognizes that his country has fully satisfied minimum conditions of the Kimberley process, the system to ensure so-called conflict diamonds do not enter world markets. South Africa's ruling party has postponed a parliamentary inquiry into corruption allegations against President Jacob Zuma. The ANC says the committee does not have the time to consider the matter before elections that are less than 10 days away. VOA's Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
Just 6 weeks after South Africa's top anti-corruption official issued a 400-page report detailing how Mr. Zuma used $23 million of public funds to make renovations to his private home, an investigative committee in Parliament, which met only twice, dropped its inquiry. The official reason, not enough time before elections. Cyril Ramaphosa is Mr. Zuma's deputy in the ruling ANC party and will be second in command of the nation if the ANC triumphs in the May 7th elections, as it is expected to. Ramaphosa dismisses opposition allegations that this is a political dodge.
And so that matter of the Nkandla report is going to be handled clearly in the next parliament. And that, in many ways, is a practical, very practical decision. Because right now, the committee having been set up, it would practically not be able to even complete the process of dealing with that report, because it is a huge report, and indeed there's still other further things that need to be done. if you look at the terms of reference that were crafted by the Speaker. So we are satisfied that this matter is going to be handled as we move on.
Opponents of the ANC have criticized its record on unemployment, corruption and service delivery to poor South Africans. And many analysts expect the party's margin of victory in next week's elections to be smaller than normal. But the party of the late Nelson Mandela appears to retain a hold on most South African voters. Ramaphosa, a former union activist turned millionaire businessman, displaced Mr. Zuma's current deputy at the ANC's national conference in 2012. That move puts Ramaphosa on a direct path to be the ANC's presidential candidate if Mr. Zuma finishes a possible second term in 2019, or to inherit the presidential mantle if Mr. Zuma does not finish that term. On Tuesday, Ramaphosa made light of his aspirations.
My great ambition is to be president of the golf club where I play golf. One, that is my greatest dream. I'd like to be president of that. And I'd also like to be president of my fishing club. That is the sum total of my ambitions.
But one wonders, if the ANC remains in power, will he settle for president of South Africa? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
The owner of the Los Angeles Clippers of the U.S. National Basketball Association has been banned from the league for life because of racist remarks he made about African Americans in an audio recording. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver announced that Donald Sterling also is being fined $2.5 million, the maximum allowed under NBA rules. Indiana Pacers head coach Frank Vogel reacted to Silver's decision regarding Sterling.
I applaud the commissioner. You know, I think it's a great show of force by our commissioner. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about, you know, we don't need that kind of stuff in our league. I don't think we need that kind of stuff in our world.
On that audio recording I mentioned earlier, a male voice is heard asking a woman who is of Latino and African heritage not to post photos of African Americans on her Instagram page and to not bring African Americans to his basketball games. The Clippers right now are competing in the NBA playoffs. Indiana Pacers' David West, who's a forward for that team, and his team is also in the playoffs, spoke about the NBA decision regarding Donald Sterling.
I mean, he's 80 years old, so his life ain't that much, don't have that much more life to live. So, I mean, you know, it's, I guess it's good. You know, I'm glad that they did something to remove him. He still has ownership. Still is going to profit from the team, but it's a step in the right direction.
A number of the L.A. Clippers advertisers also begun canceling or suspending their sponsorships of the team. The NBA is a diverse, multicultural professional league in which about 70% of the players are African-American. It also includes nearly 100 players from almost 40 countries. And one last item before we say goodbye. Residents of the southern United States facing more severe weather after 2 days of tornadoes flattened neighborhoods and killed at least 30 people. The deaths occurred across six states from Oklahoma to Alabama. Brutal storm system hit Arkansas and Mississippi the hardest, downing trees and power lines and reducing homes and businesses to rubble. And President Obama offered his condolences to the storm's victims and promised that the U.S. government will help them recover and to rebuild. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. And a reminder, you can find our programming anytime on voanews.com, right there on the Internet. We hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On April 30th, 1789, George Washington took the oath of office to become the first president of the United States. The ceremony took place on the balcony of Federal Hall on Wall Street in New York City. In 1803, the United States purchased the Louisiana Territory from France for $15 million, more than doubling the size of the nation. In 1888, the deadliest hailstorm on record killed at least 230 people and destroyed much of the farming town of Moradabad in northern India. In 1927, Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford became the first celebrities to leave their footprints in concrete at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood. Grauman was not the sole owner of the place, even though it bears only his name. His business partners in the venture were none other than, you guessed it, Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks. In 1939, the U.S. broadcaster NBC began regularly scheduled television programs in New York City. NBC televised President Franklin D. Roosevelt's address for the opening of the New York World's Fair. On this day in 1975, the war in Vietnam ended as South Vietnam announced its unconditional surrender to North Vietnamese forces. The surrender came shortly after the United States withdrew its support for the government in Saigon. In 1993, the European Organization for Nuclear Research near Geneva, Switzerland, announced it would make the World Wide Web available to the general public for free with no fees required for its use. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
We bowed our heads in remembrance of the more than 800,000 men, women, and children who were so ruthlessly deprived of life, U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Samantha Power said recently, in marking the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide at a United Nations Security Council briefing on the prevention and fight against genocide. As a global community, we recognize that mass atrocities may emerge from a variety of scenarios, she said. We've begun to identify telltale patterns and indicators. We've agreed on the value of vigilance to prevent unstable situations from unraveling. We have affirmed the duty of each government to protect its citizens from mass atrocities, and we have stated our preparedness under the United Nations Charter to respond when states require help in fulfilling that duty. It is both fair and profoundly unsatisfying to admit that our successes have been partial, and the crimes against humanity that persist are devastating, she continued. Too often we have done too little, waited too long, or been caught unprepared by events that should not have surprised us. Moving forward, Ambassador Power indicated that we have to do a better job confronting and defeating the practitioners of hate. Part of protecting against mass atrocities is preventing the conditions that allow them: rampant discrimination, the denial of human dignity, and the codification of bigotry, Ambassador Power said. No one should be targeted for violence simply because of who they are or what they believe. In our collective effort to prevent mass atrocities, we must make creative use of every tool we have: human rights monitoring, diplomatic missions, technical assistance, arms embargoes, smart sanctions, peace operations, judicial inquiries, truth commissions, courts, and other measures designed to influence the calculations of perpetrators, who every day they are doing a cost-benefit analysis about whether the cost of moving forward exceeds the benefits from their often warped perspective, she emphasized. We must remember that preventing mass atrocities is a global responsibility, Ambassador Power said. We must ask every state to consider whether there is more it can do to remove the political roadblocks that impede effective action.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.